Hey there, how's your day going? I'm Sam Searles, Word of Mouth's production intern this summer. As you know, this show is powered by listener questions, and I've been blown away by your comments and questions so far as we're working on our North Country series. We're also taking your questions on our next series about youth in New Hampshire. And first, we're taking a look at sex ed, sexual education. What do you want to know? If you're older, what do you wish you'd learned? Questions about the laws around it? Who teaches it? We want to hear from those of you currently in it. How should it look as more genders and sexualities enter the classroom? Our stories depend on listener input. There's no us without you. If you have comments or questions on sex ed in New Hampshire, you can email us at wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Again, that's wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Thanks, and here's the show.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Jimmy Gutierrez, here with our newest addition to the squad, Sam Searles.
Our latest series for Only in New Hampshire has us looking north. We got dozens of questions about the North Country, and today we're answering a trio of them. Three mysteries of a sort.
When you think of ghost towns, you might picture something from a western, let's say. A dusty town abandoned after a gold rush, no obvious signs of life, a random tumbleweed. But ghost towns are all over the place, including here in New Hampshire. Samer Califf called us with a question about a town with a population of zero. Nada, none, zilch. Here's producer Hannah McCarthy.
This is Samer.
So, Samer noticed that in the year 2000 U.S. Census, there were three people living in Livermore, New Hampshire. But in the year 2010, they were gone. So he wanted to know what happened to them.
The concept of ghost towns kind of interested me anyway.
That's the tricky thing about this census question, Samer. Livermore is a ghost town. As in, no longer alive. The town was abandoned about 60 years ago. Population zero. Oh, and it happens to be smack dab in the middle of the White Mountain National Forest. You go up a long dirt road, narrow in places where the river has washed it out, and there are ruins. Bricks crumbling into overgrown foundations, the odd bed frame or bank vault slowly becoming one with the forest.
Oh, cool, there's an old Pepsi can. Totally gonna get tetanus.
So, how did three people end up on the census for a ghost town on public land? Well, I kind of figured it had to be a hoax.
That's not really how it works in terms of, the census has a list of addresses that, you know, that they send forms to.
This is Ken Gallagher from the New Hampshire Office of Energy and Planning. It turns out you can't play a practical joke on the U.S. Census. They have a list.
Having the list of addresses first would prevent somebody living in Concord, for instance, saying, oh, I live in Livermore, that sort of thing. That just doesn't happen.
According to Ken, if the census says someone lives in Livermore, then there's got to be a place for someone to live in Livermore. The only problem is I couldn't find that place. Not on maps or search engines or in old phone books. Besides, we were talking about a national forest. Who lives in a national forest?
When you see the maps of the White Mountain National Forest, you might see one, big green blob, right? This is where the boundaries are. However, that's just the maximum boundary of the forest. Within the national forest, it's much more of a patchwork.
And this is how I learned about inholdings. Private land within public land. So that green blob, the boundary of the forest, it only tells you where the U.S. Forest Service can own land. But they don't own everything in there.
I would expect probably at least 10% of the land within the what's called the proclamation boundary may well be privately owned.
So it isn't that weird for someone to live in a national forest. But it is still pretty weird for someone to live in a town where, nobody lives.
Essentially, we believe nobody lives there. But you might want to check with, Grafton County, the Grafton County office.
Good morning, Deeds Office.
So I took Ken's advice, and I called Beth Wyman at the Grafton County Deeds Office. I have a question about what may or may not be an inholding in the boundaries of Livermore.
Yeah, I remember we have seen a deed before come through here in Livermore, but you don't know the name of the owner or anything like that.
Okay, listeners, at this point, I did happen to have a name. It was a name that popped up over and over again while I was digging around online. Two people that just might be the key to solving this mystery. Bob and Betty Shackford of Conway, New Hampshire.
Okay, yeah, I do see things listed for them in Livermore. And the latest thing I have was in 2005.
There are only 12 acres of private land left in Livermore. The rest is national forest. And all 12 are deeded, to this day, to the Shackfords. But that's where the trail went cold, because Bob passed away in 1992, and Betty, it turns out, died just this spring. But how did they end up owning the land in the first place? And why was Livermore abandoned? To find out, I spoke with Peter Crane, a White Mountain historian who did his doctoral dissertation on Livermore in the early 1990s. Livermore might be a collection of crumbling ruins now, but it had a good 50-year run. The town sprang up in the 1870s when two brothers, the Saunders, decided to launch a logging operation in the White Mountains. They built a town, a mill, and a railroad. Workers moved in and brought their families, and the brothers built a company store and then a school. And for a while, that town thrived, turning timber into lumber, lumber into cash. People were married, babies were born. By 1900, the population hit around 200. But then, things started to go downhill. The Saunders brothers died and left the whole operation to an attorney who might not have known how to run a lumber company. Population in 1920, 98. And then a fire destroyed the mill, and their one train on the Sawyer River Railroad fell into the river. And then there was a huge flood in 1927. That took out the railroad itself. Population in 1930, 23. And then, of course, there are the trees, the whole reason the town was built to begin with. In just a few decades, the loggers of Livermore had cut most of the good stuff. Population in 1940, 4 souls. By 1950, the town was empty. A year after that, it was disincorporated. Population in 1960, 0. In 1970, 1980, 1990, 0. In 2000, 3.
We have people all the time come up during the summer, and they're always curious of how we acquired Livermore, and I love telling the story on.
I met the Shackfords, three generations of them, in Bob and Betty's home in Conway, after spending weeks tracking down a phone number. And I spoke with Matt, Mark, and Gary, that's Bob and Betty's grandson and two of their three sons. It turns out they tell their story all the time, because it's a pretty good one. When Bob first bought the place, there was an original Livermore house on the property, a 26-room mansion owned by those loggers back in the day. But transient hippies were in the habit of spending the night
fornicating in the bedrooms.
Yes, there was a lot of those.
Tearing down the inside. Fire, you know, yeah. They'd rip it up all apart. And
here and there.
You know, they wouldn't go out and chop wood. They'd just take down a nice and dry wood, you know.
Right.
Eventually, Bob had to raise the mansion, but he built the camp in its place, a little red cabin not far from the ruins of old Livermore. It was a cabin that he would share with his children and eventually his grandson, Matt, the man who holds the key to the Livermore Three.
That was me. I walked up to the gentleman. He was asking if we lived there. I said I'd like to, and kind of as a joke, I threw it out that we lived there, and at least for the summer. And he said, "Hey, so
hopeful thinking, I think. I was wishing I could live up there for a year.
So that's the story. A census taker ran into Matt and his parents up at the old camp, and wishful thinking turned into official census data. None of the Shackfords are actually residents of Livermore, but their inheritance means a lot to them. All of them agree there's something still very much alive about Livermore.
And
you still feel it.
You really can. You can feel the spirit of Livermore and the town.
I gave Sammer a call to let him know that I got to the bottom of his census question.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. So it is, it's kind of somewhat a clerical error, but it's an interesting journey to that clerical error. I thought for a second when you were talking about parcels of land, there's going to be some kind of origin for like a Stephen King novel or something. But the actual answer was also incredibly interesting too.
My pleasure, Sammer. And who knows? If Matt Shackford gets his way, Livermore might find its way back onto the U.S. Census in a slightly more legitimate way.
I'd like to build a few more houses and get 12 people living up there and be the first ones to vote and re-up the town. And
Yeah. Maybe we'll do that.
Yeah.
Ever walk by a private road with no end in sight and wonder, what's down there? Well, one listener wrote in about a place that she'd never seen, only heard of, a place tucked into the woods of northern New Hampshire.
Oh, I was curious about something I'd heard about from a friend, that there was something called the Percy Summer Club in northern New Hampshire, which was fairly close to where I grew up in northern New Hampshire, and I had never heard of this place.
Tucked in the Kaufman Forest in Stark, New Hampshire, there's a lake that was once rumored to be bursting with trout. And around that lake, Adirondack Cottages, grown-up summer camp.
The most charming and successful little association of sportsmen it has ever been my fortune to know about.
That's founding member and secretary of the Percy Summer Club, George Rowell.
Actually, it's producer Taylor Quimby. George Rowell is dead.
Just go with it, though. See, Rowell was actually a fancy ad exec from New York City, but he and his similarly fancy friends loved tramping through unspoiled woods looking for the perfect fishing spot. And one day, they found it.
I, and a less experienced companion, brought into camp 364 brook trout, and regretted, after the count, that we had not taken one more to correspond with the days in the year.
So, George, you see this fishy lake and this undeveloped forest land all around it.
North of the White Mountains, a wild space with whole townships that had never had an inhabitant.
And you invite your fancy friends, including newspaper magnate Samuel Kaufman.
A better informed man, it has never been my lot to know.
To buy up 350 acres in Stark, New Hampshire, including the lovely North Lake.
Which we renamed Christine Lake after the very first lady to visit our camp.
Right, it was a bit of a boys' club for a while. But the sportsmen came to stay every summer and eventually brought their families, and they built some cottages, and people still visit today.
But that is so not the whole story.
I don't know if that's George or Taylor talking, but either way, he's right. Because the people of Stark, New Hampshire, where the Percy Summer Club set up shop, were also fond of Lake Christine. And Lake Christine's trout.
The people of Coos County have always fished in North Pond, and they continued to fish in it. Litigation followed, thick and fast, and the club lost in every court in the state.
Thanks, unknown reporter for Forest and Stream magazine in 1908, otherwise known as producer Molly Donahue.
You're welcome.
There was a lot going on with this case, but basically, regular people wanted to keep using the lake, New Hampshire kept telling them that they could, and the summer club kept saying that they couldn't. And this went on for a long time.
For a quarter of a century, the litigation that resulted from trespassing on the club preserve cost large sums of money.
This actually contributed to case law in the early 20th century. The state ruled that a body of water bigger than 10 acres was public water. So the club had to deed public access to the state. They built a road to Christine Lake, and things eventually settled down between the summer club and the public.
But that isn't the whole story.
Right. To get the rest of it, I had to visit Percy Summer Club. It's like a gated community, except the gate is a mountain lake and the surrounding woods. 7 rambling lakeside cottages looking just like they did at the turn of the century. Canoes and kayaks at every dock, kids shouting to each other across the lake. I cannot stress enough how idyllic this place is. So, how does someone get into this club? Well, in all likelihood, you don't. Most houses and memberships are inherited, passed on to whichever relative is in line for the coveted spot. Once in a blue moon, a space does become available, but even if you're lucky enough to hear about it, to know the summer club at all, for that matter, you're not the only one who wants one of these places. And membership means something. It isn't just owning a great lake house. Percy Summer Club was founded with conservation in mind. Protecting Christine Lake was just the start. These days, there are bigger fish to fry.
Northern Pass development is absolutely running 180 degrees against the momentum and the economic development and the just intrinsic value of the place that is being recognized by so many more people now. It just seems foolish to do.
This is Field Ryder. He and his wife, Susan Percy, are current club members. They say the club has doubled down on their conservationist effort in the past few decades. They've worked with the Forest Society to keep the surrounding woods and mountains pristine, put most of their land into conservation easement, and they're speaking out against Northern Pass, a project that would bring transmission lines through the Kaufman Forest and passing over club land.
And so we're looking at it that the public, our responsibility to the public, to ensure a legacy that the club members started way back in the 1800s is preserved.
And these days, the public does have access to Christine Lake and can hike the surrounding forest and peaks, see for miles across the Great North Woods. But there are some views, Northern Pass or no, that most people will never glimpse. Like that from a private lakeside cottage at the Percy Summer Club. For Only in New Hampshire, I'm Hannah McCarthy.
That question came from Emily Barak. Producer Hannah McCarthy went down that mysterious road to find an answer.
More word of mouth after a break. Stay with us. Hey there. How's your day going? I'm Sam Searles, Word of Mouth's production intern this summer. As you know, this show is powered by listener questions, and I've been blown away by your comments and questions so far as we're working on our North Country series. We're also taking your questions on our next series about youth in New Hampshire. And first, we're taking a look at sex ed, sexual education. What do you want to know? If you're older, what do you wish you'd learned? Questions about the laws around it? Who teaches it? We want to hear from those of you currently in it. How should it look as more genders and sexualities enter the classroom? Our stories depend on listener input. There's no us without you. If you have comments or questions on sex ed in New Hampshire, you can email us at wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Again, that's wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Thanks, and here's the show. Welcome back to Word of Mouth. I'm Sam Searles. This week, we're answering some of your questions about the North Country. Our next question came from right inside our own building. NHPR's digital director, Rebecca Lavoy, had a question about unincorporated towns, the majority of which are in Coas County. Here's Hannah and Rebecca.
So, Rebecca, you asked a question about New Hampshire's hinterlands.
Actually, they're called unincorporated places.
Yeah, right. So what did you want to know exactly?
I think my question, as I worded it, was, what's up with unincorporated towns? Can you break the law there and not get into trouble? And who organizes things in these towns?
Yes. Okay. So to get to the bottom of this, I decided to go to what I'm going to call the Mac Daddy of unincorporated places in New Hampshire. So that's Coas County. So there are 25 unincorporated places in the state, according to nh.gov, and 23 of those are in Coas County.
Right.
So if you look at a map, it's like a fourth of that county is just unincorporated, like, wildling land.
North of the wall.
Exactly. So I hate to disappoint you, but I'm going to start right off the bat with the fact that basically they're not the perfect place for the perfect crime.
Oh.
No. You cannot break the law.
This is Jennifer Fish with Coas County.
The unincorporated places are governed by the state police and also some local police departments and the sheriff's department. So, you know, you can't break the law there and you can get pulled over for speeding and anything like that.
Well, it's kind of a bummer, but to be honest, I did kind of figure that that was probably the case. We probably would have heard about it if you could just commit a murder there and not get arrested. But it doesn't really answer my question of who is in charge of these towns, who is running them.
In the unincorporated places, it's the county government that oversees the organization of those places. So it's basically the three county commissioners are the selectmen for those unincorporated places.
They oversee the budget, approve timber taxes.
The county also has a planning board for the unincorporated places that meets on a monthly basis.
All right, but what about day-to-day stuff? What about stuff like water and trash collection and sewers and stuff like that that you would expect to get from your town?
Yeah, so that is the one thing about unincorporated places. They have to get all of these services because they don't have any of their own, you know, dump access police, firefighters, ambulances, schools, from nearby towns, from their neighbors. So the county collects this fee from the homeowners in these places, and that money goes to whatever town lets the people in, like, Hale's location use their dump.
So does it make it expensive to live in one of these towns?
Actually, it can end up working out pretty well for the homeowners because that fee that they're paying to the county is based on like usage estimates and how many kids are going to public school in a given year from that place. So when they've got a population of like three dozen retired people.
Some of those places, because there are so few people and they receive timber taxes, their revenues may exceed their expenses, so some taxpayers in unincorporated places don't pay property tax.
Actually, my mind is blown by that, because as you know, property taxes are really high in New Hampshire because of the way our whole education funding system works. People complain about them a lot in small towns. So it sounds like these places are like tax havens. It's sort of like the dream in New Hampshire. You get to live somewhere and not pay property tax. Kind of a sweet deal.
Well, so it can be. But there is this one story where things get a little wacky. Do you have a little more time to dig a little deeper on this?
Heck yeah, I do.
Okay, cool.
Just recently, within the last year, there was an article in the local newspaper here that the residents of Millsfield, the unincorporated place of Millsfield, mm-hmm. was looking to incorporate.
So a few years ago, Millsfield got kind of spooked. And it's a complicated and kind of controversial story, but there was this moment when the people in Millsfield thought that they were going to have to pay these absurdly high property taxes to kind of make up for the value of this wind farm that was built on their turf.
How could something like that happen?
Yeah, well, so I think that's what the people in Millsfield were thinking. It was like this reality check for them. And then in the end, the state passed legislation and that, you know, property tax disaster didn't actually happen. But the whole thing caused some really bad blood between the county and the unincorporated place that the county was in charge of. And it got these Millsfielders thinking that they might want to take control of their own destiny.
So the Millsfielders may want to become a real town?
Yeah. I talked to Tom Claflin, who's a resident of Millsfield, and he explained that they are looking into it.
So what? They just say they want to be a town and they're a town? Like, what do they have to do to be a town?
So it's really complicated. And I think, you know, it revealed itself to be way more complicated than even the people of Millsfield thought. So it'll ultimately take passing a bill in the legislature where they say, okay, you are now an incorporated town. But becoming a municipality also means setting up a school board, a planning board, a fire department, a police department, and you have to build a physical town hall, and then you have to staff that town hall with clerks. So it's a lot of work and a lot of money, and it takes a lot of people.
Right. And I'm also thinking, like, you have to get on maps. So that's a whole other process there. You have to get in, like, the geolocating stuff. You have to, like, become a place that is called a different thing. So I guess what I'm wondering is, it seems like a lot of work, and then they'll be stuck with a huge amount of responsibility. Is it even worth it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like a crazy metamorphosis and there are a lot of growing pains to it. So Tom told me that they aren't really sure yet. They're going to take their time on this one. So stay tuned. Millsfield might like fall off the list of unincorporated places in a couple of years.
Huh. Well, it's a very cool answer, very complete. I'm disappointed about not being able to commit a murder and getting away with it in any of these places. But it is way more than I ever thought I would get to know about these unincorporated New Hampshire places. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure. You're welcome, Rebecca.
Thanks for tuning in to Word of Mouth this week. This week's show was produced by Hannah McCarthy, Rebecca Lavoy, Sam Searles, and me, Jimmy Gutierrez. Erica Janik is our executive producer.
And remember, we're looking for your questions about sex ed in New Hampshire, as well as anything else you've wondered about our state. Send us an email at wordofmouth@nhpr.org. Word of Mouth is a production of NHPR.
Sure is.